Hello and welcome to Matt D'Elia is Confused. This is Matt D'Elia, and this week's episode is about something that has long confused the shit out of me. But after talking to this week's guest, I'm thoroughly unconfused, and for that I am grateful. This week's guest does have a name, and his name is Dale Barron. Dale wrote a book called It Came From Something Awful: How a Toxic Troll Army Accidentally Memed Donald Trump into Office. It's about 4chan and 8chan and the entire weird, fucked up subculture that gave rise to it. Disillusioned, lonely, angry, youngish white men who had a place to now congregate and be lonely and angry and disillusioned together. Not so surprisingly, that didn't take long to metastasize into something extremely hateful and dark. It became a gathering place of white nationalists and incels. And, you know, in many ways, it's something that I wish I could ignore, but it is something that feels very prominent in culture, which is what made me pick up the book to try to understand it. The book is amazing. Talking to Dale was even more amazing. Thank you, Dale, for your time. We go through it. He makes sense of it for me, answering my questions, which I deeply appreciate. And I'm very happy that I can share this episode with you. I've been wanting to understand this shit for a while, and now I feel like I do. Feel fucking great. So here is my conversation with Dale Barron, author of It Came From Something Awful. Thanks for listening. Okay.
Yeah, I work as a writer and a cartoonist for a long time. Before that, started as a internet cartoonist doing a webcomic. I was writing fiction, cartoons, sort of things like that, but also essays on Medium and other places. And I wrote one on the alt-right in 2016, kind of right before everyone really knew about it, or I was maybe like ahead of the curve a month or two or something. Right. People liked the essay. It explained their origins online and in 4chan and things like that. And then I wrote a longer book about the same subject because people wanted to know more about that topic, particularly as it metastasized over the next few years into something that didn't really go away.
For sure, yeah. And the book is It Came From Something Awful. That's the title, right?
Yes, right. I should be mentioning the title. I should be plugging the book.
Yeah, I'm trying to help you out here. Yeah. Sell some copies. I mean, for everyone listening, definitely read it regardless of what you're about to hear, because the book is amazing. And I kind of want to like go through it the way you go through it, which is you kind of give like a little bit of a good chunk of the book is sort of a history of like before it even becomes the thing that I had heard of, which is the 4chan. Like I remember when I first heard of 4chan, I was like, well, I don't even know what that is. And then not until 8chan did I even start to even really understand like at all. So there's this groundswell though, and it sort of came from anime in Japan. Is that right?
I trace the origins through American counterculture. So when I first discovered 4chan or learned about 4chan when it was just starting around 2004, 2005, though it was founded at the end of 2003, it was very strange. It was sort of just a website that was peculiar, that was anime themed, manga themed. But it quickly kind of just swelled into this huge, one of the largest sites online in the next few years. It became a cultural phenomenon. So the book tries to answer, well, how does that fit into, well, why did that happen? And so I had to kind of think about, well what was this counterculture and what was counterculture before it and afterwards? It was founded in this kind of a celebration of escapism, celebration of sort of just dropping out, living on the internet, living, watching manga and watching anime, or reading manga, watching anime all day. What's called otakuism in Japan. So it was really sort of a dropout culture at first that was very nihilistic. Right. And it held on to that, of course, through the years. It's still nihilistic. Mm-hmm.
The nihilism, you sort of trace that in an interesting way, almost from the counterculture of the 70s into this sort of cynicism of the 90s hackers up into this nihilism, to use a term that is often associated with 4chan, trolls, like this troll culture. And I found that super interesting, that sort of line that you trace. Because I think for me, when I think of, and I think this is true of a lot of people on the left, at least like when Trump came along and when that whole sort of counterculture vibe of what came with it came along, to me, it came out of nowhere, right? Like to [S2] Sure. [S1] Me, I didn't know about it at all until basically everyone knew about it. And at that point, a lot of us were just like, what the fuck is this? It was already right. It was already a tidal wave, and none of us had even known it was a small small wave. Just sort of, it wasn't even on our radar at all. But I think it's interesting the way you sort of track it. Can you talk a little bit about that, sort of like how it came even into being at all before 4chan, all of that?
Sure. Yeah, and I think it kind of surprised everyone. Even the people on 4chan were surprised that this movement grew out of it and grew so large.
Right.
So I try and track how 4chan became a countercultural phenomenon before the alt-right stuff grew out of it, which was much later on in 2014. So this idea that in the 60s and 70s, counterculture was based on this idea of like a radical leftist change, and the idea that like, oh, well, life is sort of what society offers is very unsatisfying in terms of like possibilities for, adequate or sort of fulfilling work or adequate housing, stuff like that. And it was also, there was this rebellion against escapism, against sort of like this idea that people would be kind of caught in false technological worlds and sort of like using products to as escapism, sort of to like feed the void of their unhappiness through that means.
Right.
But by the 70s, a lot of that stuff had been co-opted by the mainstream culture, and so counterculture kind of became, you know, there was punk and this idea that like, oh, well, we're just going to kind of be so filthy and disgusting that we're just going to be uncooptable, but that got co-opted.
Yeah.
And so by the 80s and 90s, when there was this explosion of marketing and more and products that were marketed to young children and like escapist worlds and more fantasy and TV than ever, that meant that by the 90s, sort of youth culture was really about like this hyper nihilism that was like, oh, we're going to be so nihilistic and uncaring that you can't co-opt it, that there's nothing to steal. There's nothing inside our hearts, so you can't really take it. And we're going to be so indifferent because all of these different marketing strategies and value systems are sort of tugging at us at the same time. So we're just going to be just totally indifferent to it all. And that was the internet culture of the late 90s, what I call the something awful 90s nihilistic culture. So there was this other website that 4chan grew out of called Something Awful. Mm-hmm. And that's really kind of 4chan inherited that idea that we're just going to then drop out and hang out on the internet. And what happened over the next decade was that prospects got worse for young people. All of those problems just got worse. Sort of the access to adequate housing or to fulfilling jobs or getting your own apartment or all of that, or, you know, education, right? They were more economically on the bottom than ever. And then the other half was that these escapist green worlds just kept expanding, they exploded, that it was even easier to drop out and live on the internet. So that culture expanded. And it really, what happened was that by 2012, 2013, it had already sort of gone through a few cycles. And the idea was that, where do we go from nihilism? It's sort of like hit rock bottom. And you're like, people had been on the site for like 10 years. Right. And they're like, my life hasn't changed. And that created this weird swing to the far right, where they began in their sort of hopelessness to say, okay, well, my life hasn't worked out because like the modern world and all of society is so disgusting and we need to discard it. And so all of these fascist ideas, for a variety of reasons, became deeply appealing to them. They sort of found solidarity in race thinking, because it was like they were so alienated and isolated, and they were so humiliated that they found sort of that last vestige was like, oh, well, I'll be proud. They needed pride. So they sort of discovered it in their whiteness, naively. And then they felt like, oh, well, like, I'm also dissipated. I sort of like, I don't have any value system. I don't know what I'm doing with my life. So they kind of clung like a lifeline to like a hyper traditionalist conservative viewpoint. It became this sort of protective bubble for them against this idea that they were just like in their parents' basement, like consuming pornography all day. So, So weirdly enough, 4chan became one of these starting points for this fascist resurgence that we saw in like 2015, 2016.
Right. And the appeal in the first place of a site like 4chan, from what I understand, from what I can gather, it's that you can actually be anonymous on there. You don't need to sign up. There's no account. You can just – is that right? Like, is that why that sort of fomented and became the place for this kind of thinking?
It was one of the reasons, yeah. I guess to describe what 4chan is to people who don't know, it's essentially a message board system. It was a little different at its time because it was anonymous, so you didn't have to sign up for a user account, which meant that people could behave really badly. That's essentially what it came down to. It was very tolerant in terms of what content it would allow, and was very, because it was run by teenagers essentially, so there was very lax moderation. So it was really kind of considered the dark underbelly of the internet, or sort of the sludge at the bottom for a long time. But in that, it was also sort of deeply creative. So it's where the internet meme more or less came from. And it started, there was also a far leftist movement, far leftist sort of libertarian movement, the anonymous movement, that the hacktivist movement that came out of it in 2008, when it was sort of the same group of idle young men, or a similar group, were like, oh, well, we want to start a political coalition on the far left, mm-hmm. Out of the sort of hacker and troll collectives. It was this very peculiar place that was sort of known as a dark, weird underbelly of the internet, that where a lot of the internet's culture also came from.
Right. That's something I find extremely interesting that I actually had no idea about. I didn't know that Anonymous, the hacker group, was actually born out of 4chan. And that sort of, I think, is something that doesn't – I have no place to put that in my brain, because what I think of when I think of 4chan, I think of something extremely far right, which is how it is now and how it has been since I've known about it. So to learn that something that was – far left actually came out of that, it almost speaks to the vacuum that was, it was just to be sucked in it by some kind of ideology. It seems like everyone was just so ready to be sucked in by something that far left, far right, it almost didn't matter. That's my reading of it, at least. So, but how does that work? Like, how does that go from this nihilistic point of view and then this sort of far left hacktivism thing coming out of it, and then how does that swing so hard to the right so fast?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's a bizarre story that 4chan's founded in 2003. It quickly becomes this place where it's hundreds of thousands of idle young men kind of gathering there, coalescing into trolling collectives, and really more or less inventing meme culture. And so by 2007, they feel very powerful, because this is memes are becoming this worldwide phenomenon. They're being written by the newspaper and sort of catching on everywhere. Their trolling collectives are like very effective in the sense that they kind of pull these big pranks. They get into news media, and they feel like, oh, well, we're idle, but we're very powerful.
Right.
And so they kind of realize they have a lot of autonomy, and they actually do have some power, even though 4chan was about dropping out and sort of this idea that, oh, we're powerless, so we're going to drop out and live on our lives on the internet.
Right.
And so they found collective power that way. And that more or less it was first a joke. It was first a prank, this idea that they were this hacktivist collective, but then the mask became the face and they became a real hacktivist collective. And it was really born out of this groping for, a value system. Like, cause you can't really be a nihilist for that long. You just can't live in that vacuum forever.
Right.
That movement really took off 2011. It started in 2008. And then by the 2012, 2013, the FBI took notice. It was shattered. A lot of the main principal players got arrested. So then there was another vacuum after a lot of that movement broke. So what happened was another group of young men who were now just coming of age, who were 15, 16, 17, 18, were sort of more hopeless, more immersed in screen worlds and nihilistic despair and sort of otaku culture. Like every time 4chan thought, oh, we can't get even more depraved. We can't get even worse. We can't get even more sort of like dropped out and obsessive over like how antisocial we're going to be. But it just kept happening. And particularly after Anonymous dissolved, there was sort of a moral vacuum there that the people that had done that were gone or had left to go to other sites. And what was left were older men who were maybe 35 or something and who had been on 4chan for 10 years, miserable, and their lives hadn't changed much. And then a new group of young people who felt very despairing and even worse. So that was the new group that then formed the alt-right, where they're like, well, we still can't stay nihilists. We need something else to get us out of this situation.
I'm interested in how this sort of foundation, the possibility of this to sort of spring up in the first place seems important to the whole story. And you talk about that a bit in the book, this sort of, my reading of it is sort of like, you know, you talk about a lot about fascism and where it really comes from. And Hannah Arendt, you talk about her a lot. And there's this thing that I kept thinking about, which was this otaku culture, which is a Japanese term, which we can define in a minute, but the foundation of that sort of being primed, the pump being primed here in America for that sort of culture, I think was also something that was a bit of a surprise. Just even the idea that there's this almost subculture, subclass of people, and so many of them with such a specific attitude about life at the moment, even just that foundation, I think, was a bit of a head scratcher for me when it started to bubble up and become a thing. And I think to sort of talk about how, because you mentioned, you know, the nihilism sort of gassing out, and right. also the teenagers who had been on the site sort of now as older, sort of angrier men.
Right.
To just talk a little bit about that, like that bed that was already here, even with or without 4chan, because I feel like 4chan was the match on the kindling, but there was already the kindling ready for this kind of thing and this place, kind of place for people to gather.
Right. Yeah. So I guess I, as I wrote about a little bit in the book and the original essay, I felt like I was sort of one of the demographic of the older men, in the sense that I was on 4chan early, reading it in my idle time, but also statistically, I was just one of those men that I'm 39 now. That after 2008 crash, I just really didn't find a job. And like, there was sort of like many years where I just wasn't making any money, and it was like easier to just sort of drop out of life. Mm-hmm. And statistically, that is sort of like a group of people set in a larger group of young people who have those same problems with finding an adequate job, or like high rents, not being able to move out of your parents' house, or not being able to save money, and having educational debt, and not getting health insurance, all of that stuff.
Right.
So that, you know, that created a lot of angry, idle men.
Yeah.
So I write about like the Kessler who started the Unite the Right rally that became the massacre, the fascist massacre at Charlottesville. He was like at Occupy Wall Street. He was a little unhinged, sort of had his own social problems, but There were a lot of people that were kind of first had tried the left, mm-hmm. and then for whatever reason they were still angry and disenchanted, and then they moved to these naive fantasies of fascism on the right. And then there were these younger people. So I write about Brennan, the founder of 8chan, mm-hmm. Who just had a really hard life, but he found other people on the internet. Who were about his age, who had also dropped out and were on the chans, and who were also really felt like together on the chans, they were convincing themselves that they were doomed to be losers forever. And that was the incel movement, but there were similar movements around it that also started on 4chan, where really they're just like, we're going to be otaku, we're going to be dropped out people forever, we're doomed to be on the bottom of this like social Darwinian hierarchy. So really sort of like a groupthink of despair.
Right.
So the new group of people, like Brennan, was working. He has disabilities and he was in foster care, but he was working when he finally sort of got a modicum, like a scrap of independence. He was working as a Mechanical Turk for Amazon, like making like, you know, pennies on the dollar, mm-hmm. But scrabbling by. And before he found it, 8chan and was the center of this incel movement, which then 8chan then became the center of the far right. His role was advising other young men on how they could make at least enough money in the gig economy before it was even called that, on Amazon's Mechanical Turk. That was sort of what he was known for. So it was really like it really kind of set the stage where there was all these people who were like deeply unhappy with society, and society wasn't really fulfilling their needs for them, but they were also immersed in this bizarre escapism.
Right.
That was all this consumerist escapism. And so it coalesced, you're right, around 4chan and other places, right? Like other places online and offline as well.
And to me, it's like there's the anger of these people, and then there's just the simple fact of having too much time on their hands.
Right.
And so it's this, and then along comes this place where they can sort of gather, and it can. What I find interesting is the escalation of the sort of repulsiveness of some of the things that are going on there. I mean, you over the years, you sort of track this idea of like all that stuff about N-Hero and all that shit about the suicide stuff. And then you, in the book, there's this one story that you have that is it's so fucked up to me, but I also think that it's this window into like really getting your bearings on the kind of mindset that you're among on a site like this. I mean, there's that passage about the kid who on a live stream was going to commit suicide and lit his room on fire for everyone to see. And you quote some of the users and the attitude of it. It's almost. The only way I can understand it, it's almost like their minds are so desensitized that they don't understand that this is a real death. But I think I might be wrong about that. In that, I think they just might not give a shit about someone watching someone die. They might actually understand the implications, but just not give a shit or cheer it on. I mean, there's in this open embrace of this like less than-ness or the beta-ness thing. I feel like that is like a gateway towards them sort of accepting a certain kind of attitude towards things that is so twisted and fucked up, you know. Escalation of the sickness, I guess, of the stuff on the site, it speaks to like that. I don't know. You tell me. Do you know which one it is? Like, is it this sort of desensitization, or is it this knowing embrace of that sort of darkness? You know what I mean?
Well, I think they're both right. I think certainly you're right on both counts, that there's a desensitization and also a numbness and a callousness that comes with that, where they don't care. And this idea that you're referencing, like this, which came along with the incel movement in 2013 and 2014, this idea of being a beta male, where in their groupthink they were all convincing themselves that the world was divided into this social Darwinian hierarchy, and they were alpha males and alpha people who were successful, who were out there living life outdoors, making money, achieving romantic success. And then there was them, the beta males, who had nothing. And they were, of course, it was wrong. It was totally naive that they, in their isolation, they were convincing themselves. And when I spoke to other people who were caught up in this, they described how they had to be cruel to one another because they thought, in their believing this idea of social Darwinian hierarchy, they thought, oh, in order to be an alpha male, you have to be cruel, even though they knew they were doomed to be beta. So they were just actually, even in their solidarity with each other, they were being very mean to one another.
Yeah.
And that was wrapped up in that, in this slow desensitization that was happening with consuming all of this escapist media, because the fantasies that they were consuming to replace real sensations. So they were so sad that they're powerless. So they consume bloody action movies, which are power fantasies. Mm-hmm. It's an old sell, right? Everyone does that to some extent, but they were doing it constantly, or they were romantically unsuccessful. So the other fantasy they were consuming in anime and movies and stuff was a romantic fantasy of seducing women. And as 10 years passes, that just gets more and it gets more unsatisfying, because it ultimately is. It just gets more and more depraved every time they repeat it over and over. So mm-hmm. to feel something that just gets worse and worse. So yeah, as you're describing, like then by 2012, I guess the incident you mentioned was that, yeah, there was a guy who was like, I'm going to kill myself online. I'm going to live stream. And everyone's like, everyone celebrated on 4chan.
Right.
And then they watched him set himself on fire. He survived. And then they made jokes about it afterwards that he, in fact, like got rescued, but they watched him set his room on fire. And this has expanded. So as the book came out, there were a series of 4chan and 8chan related alt-right fascist shootings, all copycats of the shooting first in Christchurch, New Zealand, which was also an 8chan fascist shooting. Mm. And it was similar. They all referenced these older Chan memes about, well, if I'm going to kill myself and I guess kill other people in the bargain now, I'm going to display, I'm going to live stream it for you. And that's what happened. All of these young men tried to live stream their massacres. And it has this Chan tradition of memes that goes back to like this incident even further back when they were celebrating suicide in their nihilistic despair in like 2005.
Right. It's just this constant escalation from one to the next to the next. And then it spills out into the real world to the point that people are actually killing people and live streaming it.
Right. And emulating the like fantasy, the screen fantasy. So right. They're consuming all these action movies as power fantasies. But of course, it's incredibly doesn't actually make you feel better. It makes you feel worse. It's right. Sort of like scratching a mosquito bite.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the end result, that they try and create their own screen action film in their sort of like the worst ones do, the most unhinged ones do.
Right. Just to interject real quick, I mean, we haven't talked about this yet, but it is a major part of the culture, and it's very, I mean, there's no way to overstate this, very anti-woman. And that sort of goes, I think, with the alt-right in people's minds in general, but some of the shit you talk about in the book, it's like, it's fucking unbelievable how anti-woman some of this shit is, or all of it really. I mean, the whole culture, as you pointed out, it sort of dovetails with inceldom and that just in general. I mean, I think naturally these kind of things go hand in hand a bit, but I think it is worth specifically talking about how much this is just by rule, not a place for women, right?
Right. It was always, 4chan was always like that. It was always deeply male and deeply misogynistic. But as it got worse, the misogyny also got worse, rankling into this incel culture, which was deeply resented women as something that these young men felt like they could never have romantic success. So it just became sour grapes. It became this sort of deep hatred of all women.
Right.
And that's, weirdly enough, the core of the alt-right. The alt-right, as I document in the book, came from Gamergate, which was this misogynistic harassment campaign of a female video game creator in 2014 that exploded off 4chan into this weird online phenomenon. And that was the time when all of these incels and people who identified as beta males on 4chan or NEETs, not in education or training or employment or training. So people who are outsiders, they formed into a political bloc after Gamergate. That was 2014. They realized, oh, we have the same interests. We all are kind of the same. We have the same problems, and we all hate women. And by 2015, the people that had led Gamergate, but really profited off it, off YouTube, like Mike Cernovich and Milo Yiannopoulos, as bloggers, they became the place that the alt-right crystallized, the people that the alt-right crystallized around. So it was just this direct line.
Right. So it coalesces with Gamergate, and then it becomes sort of a cohesive unit or mindset or something like that, from which the alt-right is really sort of focused moving forward, right?
Right, because the young men all have the same problem, more or less, which is that they feel like they're outsiders, deeply declassed people who are really on the margins or totally outside of society, and they feel degraded and humiliated. And that's more or less why this they cling to fascist thinking, because it gives them some sense of solidarity and belonging, even though they're totally alienated. And they're humiliated, so they want to feel some sort of sense of pride. And they also feel like, like as I said a little earlier, Brennan described this too, but a lot of the far right people I talked to, that they felt like all of this sitting in their mom's basement on the internet consuming stuff was, they didn't want that sort of dissipated nihilism. They felt like they needed a way to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. So like, adhering to this hyper traditionalism, which fascism obsesses over, they adored this idea. So they thought, "Oh, okay, well, I'll swear off pornography. I'll swear off all of this. I'll start weightlifting or whatever. I'll start kind of living this hyper traditional life, and that will give me these guidelines to live my life, because for 10 years I've been spinning my wheels outside of society." It's a very bizarre, but if you kind of look at the demographic, you see why these weird ideals appealed to them.
Yeah, the nihilism sort of becoming stale and spilling over into this far, far right ideology does make sense when you think about nihilism being born from this sort of, well, I have no prospects, I have no job, I have no money, I'm this sort of I'm at the bottom of the hierarchy, and I have no woman. Because that ideology over there, way on the far right, is sort of hearkening to this era, not so indirectly, sometimes very directly, when it was, I mean, we haven't even gotten to the race part yet, but I think predominantly these men are white too. So it's this idea of, well, if I sort of can work my way into this ideology, then that would mean more likely to get a job, more likely to get a woman, regardless of the means. It's like that's the sort of framework where they see a path to those things, you know, whereas I think on the left, it's this freer idea of everybody sort of in the mind of them. It's like the rigidity of it brings them things that they lack naturally. And I think that sort of makes sense when you think of it like that, you know.
Yeah, I think that's how they imagined it. To me, I thought that it would, to me, it seemed that it would bring them self-control in a sense.
Yeah, right.
And a sort of a ready-made off-the-rack suit of values. And the irony was that, of course, if you become a dyed-in-the-wool fascist, it's much harder probably to get, at least if you're out as a fascist,
right?
It's just going to isolate you further. You're not going to get women or you're not, the fascist fantasy is that these outsiders will become to the center of society. They'll join the middle of society and not be outsiders anymore. But if the opposite happens, that of course it just marginalizes them further, because a lot of them are naive or isolated because they've spent 10 years on the internet, or maybe naturally they're a lot of them have those predilections anyway. But yeah, it usually doesn't help in a sense.
Right.
And I guess the other component there is that comparing it to the left, there's this cruelty where because they're on the bottom, they're convinced that human beings and society is this sort of cruel-minded social Darwinian contest that is bloody and cruel, and it's about one person one-upping the other person, kind of like in a video game as well. Just very naive. It's not how people or the world really works, but they're convinced of it because they feel like they've been really bullied by it, or they're placed on the bottom of it. So it's a very cruel-minded idea, and it also forms that core of fascism of like authoritarianism and that like of power politics and the idea that, well, the only way I'm going to get to the top is by displacing this other group
right. That's
usurped my place on the power pyramid. And yeah, of course, the left has a more sophisticated idea, which is that if everyone forms a coalition, you're very powerful, and together, actually, in solidarity, like you can wrest power from the small group of people that have most of it, rather than sort of aligning your interests with those people.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting that you point out the fact that expressing these ideas out in the world is only going to marginalize you further, which sort of creates more of it's almost like it becomes a self-perpetuating thing. By the more you become entrenched in this ideology, the less likely you are really to kind of get out of your station, really. And then it just sort of grows and grows and grows and grows and grows.
Yeah, right. You saw it a lot in the fascist shooters, that the New Zealand shooter in his manifesto, and the other ones as well. Some of them were naive copycat, like young men who had just sort of been brainwashed by the Chans. But there's sort of this idea that, oh, well, there's still that, even when they adopt the fascism, there's still this vestige of cruel-minded, despairing nihilism, ironic nihilism, that they're like, well, I know that they both hold this fantasy in their mind that one day they'll join the center of society when modernism gets wiped away and the new fascist authoritarian system is put in place. They'll be there. But they also know that's some absurd internet fantasy that's never going to be real.
Right.
And that just rankles back into where they were in the first place, which is this ironic, nihilistic despair that convinces them they should just still be on their computer hiding away.
Right. You mentioned a word that I kept thinking about when I was reading your book, which is bully. And their sense is that they've been bullied by society and put at the bottom of the totem pole by these sort of unfair forces. But they're textbook bullies. And it's interesting to bemoan being bullied and then to turn around and be a much bigger, much more on your face bully than anything that you're accusing of bullying you. It's like, it's bullying to the point of playground bully shit. Like they are childish bullies on 4chan.
Right. I mean, yeah, right. This is like classic human nature, right? That the abused becomes the abuser, or sort of this in this contradiction that there's some unity in there where, yeah, I mean, who is the troll? Like, is the troll the person that is spending all their time harassing young girls online or making someone's life miserable? Is that person like, if you were just to hazard a guess, would they be happy? Are they a happy? Do they have like a right? Do they have a wife and kids and like a upper middle class job? No, right? There's no prospects in their life, right? They're pretty hopeless and despairing themselves, which is why they're devoting their time to something that is like, even in the cruelty, like even like the little like jolt of the dopamine maybe they get when this happens online, like then when it dissipates, they must be even more miserable.
Yeah.
It's probably not a fulfilling activity.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really just this another expression of despair, and they feel like it flips constantly where they want to be cruel, and they feel like, well, I'm cruel, therefore I'm cruel because I've gotten such an unfair shake. That's why I want to be cruel.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous, and it definitely speaks to, I mean, to me, it speaks to this, like a lot of times when these are discussed and this idea is like, oh, well, we should have designed the internet better, the networks better. Like, it's just inherent that the internet is going to be this way. You have free speech, it's going to have all these jerks everywhere. But to me, it's like graffiti on an underpass or something where it's like, it really just kind of speaks to the other societal forces that are creating it, right? That if you have a bunch of unhappy people in America in 2020 now, 2019, and then that's what's going to the internet's this blank slate. So that's what's just going to bubble up on the internet. That it's not like the internet. It's not like we had this problem. It was different in 2000 or 2010 or whatever.
Yeah.
There's a reason why it's bubbling up now that is outside of the internet.
Right. So you're saying, and I think this is important and super interesting. It's not the internet that's creating this. The internet is creating a mirror to what's going on. And what the internet is doing is allowing these people to sort of congregate and metastasize, you could argue, but it's not the internet that's creating this kind of behavior. The behavior exists, and the internet is just allowing us or whoever is like this to express it and to congregate and to sort of act it out in the world, really.
Right. Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. Yes. Amir, yeah. That's my argument, at least.
Yeah. No, that's super interesting. Now that we've mentioned the word bully, though, I think it's time to bring up the sort of where your book ends up, which is sort of in Trump land.
Right.
The commonality that I think just jumps out when one thinks of a message board site like 4chan or 8chan and just sort of the Trump way is the troll thing. But right. You sort of present this really linear kind of history of the dovetailing of this sort of 4chan, 8chan mentality and moment, and also the Trump moment. So can you talk about that a little bit, the sort of the those two sort of converging, that convergence there?
Sure, yeah. So Gamergate peters out around 2015. But the coalition still exists. And that's when Trump begins his campaign. So it's actually very quickly that there's a lot of direct links. So that's when figures like Cernovich, who was a Gamergater, switched to Trump, and also Yiannopoulos switched to Trump. And Yiannopoulos was working for Breitbart at the time, and Breitbart was run by Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon, we now know, was sort of informally advising Trump and then formally. So there was this direct link to Trump's campaign. Bannon saw this very clearly, and he has these quotes where he says, oh, they come in through Gamergate, and then they get turned on to Trump. So he spent a lot of money mobilizing through Yiannopoulos, mobilizing this coalition for Trump. And yeah, as you say, Trump uncannily mirrored a lot of this new coalition of angry, idle young men, youngish men, kind of under 40-ish, down to their teens. Mm-hmm. He was both this ironic, cheesy, silly media figure, pop culture figure that was like a meme unto himself, a creature of the screen who was silly. But he was also this outsider who was also a bullying, projected the idea in his insecurity that he was a bullying alpha male. So he was sort of both the alpha male and the beta male. He was this outsider with he looked ridiculous with his face pressed up against the glass, wanting to be an insider, angry that everyone didn't accept him as an insider. And this appealed deeply to these self-proclaimed betas on 4chan, and Trump also represented the wrecking ball, this idea that he would really wipe away, he would not only spit in the face of all these arrogant coastal elites, but he would create something totally new. And so the people who had nothing, they're like, that's fine, that's exactly what I want. The more destruction he causes, whether it's totally nihilistic and it just harms other people or it helps me, it doesn't matter because I have nothing.
Right.
So this combination of things really enamored this group to Trump. Though after 2016-2017, it's been split. They some have become disenchanted with him, others are on the chans, and this coalition are still adherents. Others have become dyed-in-the-wool fascists, and they're just looking to see who will kind of push the fascist agenda forward, whether it be Trump or other people. But during 2016 and during the campaign, it really aligned itself with Trump and helped him get elected in various ways.
And regardless of the sort of the amount of people who are engaging on 4chan or HN directly, there's still, I think what's interesting, what I think of, well, how many people are really even on there engaging directly with these message board sites? But, and regardless of what the answer is, it could be a very, very lot. It could be not that many, but they, the meme culture aspect and how locked into the internet they are, they're still driving a very particular strain of the conversation, regardless of their number, really. I mean, I don't know, but how you mentioned, I think the numbers at various points on the unique visits to sites like this. And it gets way, way up there. But even beyond the number of people who are actively engaging, there's still the – they're driving so much of the conversation. So I think that what I think that sort of gets lost in my mind. And when I read the book, I'm really reminded of the fact that the meme culture they're creating is to use metaphor I used before, it's just like it's the match on the kindling that they can accelerate so much so fast. I mean, you talk about the exponential sort of the blowing up of the Pepe meme, that frog thing,
right,
and that sort of they sort of wrangle that and push it and make sure that that becomes this icon of them. And it's interesting how much of the conversation they're sort of driving with these sort of hacker troll tactics, really.
Right. Yeah. Particularly in 2016 or during the election year. You're very right that it was unclear. I get this question a lot. They're like, well, how many of them voted? And who knows?
Right.
They're
exactly.
Anonymous. And,
exactly.
And then how much, and it's hard to quantify this cultural impact, but it really felt that they were this avant-garde sort of creative tip of the spear for the Trump campaign, where they were generating all of these memes, which were then getting spit out into the culture. And it became these cultural points where they co-opt Pepe the Frog, who before had just symbolized being a sad loser on the internet. He came from 4chan, well, not originally, but popularized by 4chan right. as a meme. And then we have these cultural moments where the neo-Nazi Richard Spencer on the day of Trump's inauguration is pointing to his Pepe Frog pin, about to explain it, and then he gets punched by Antifa, right? And so it's like, for whatever reason, these cultural creations become one of these like secret underpinnings or one of these undergirders of the cultural conversation around these topics.
Right.
So yeah, it's and I think that that's still the case. So much has changed. It's just it's so dynamic.
Yeah.
In the past few years that HN is gone now.
Right.
It got shut down because of these fascist massacres that were then occurring on HN. That was the next evolution, that they were so despairing, and possibly because they were disappointed in Trump, but just because obviously their fantasies of what they thought would happen were deeply naive, that the next phase really became this set of terrorist acts. And now 4chan still exists, but I don't think it has the cultural power it did in 2016. If anything, I think it's slowly deflating. Maybe the exception being the QAnon stuff has also left both 4chan and HN. So we'll see kind of going into the future whether it is as powerful, but the alt-right as a coalition, this idea that there is a fascist youth movement in the United States now, mm-hmm. Which is just in any significant way never really existed
right.
Before. That's not going away in some ways. There, it's at least for the time being here to stay.
Yeah.
We'll see how it changes. It's definitely going to mutate. It's just kind of for hard sure. to say how.
So what is the state of this sort of, I don't even know if, I guess, subculture. Where is it centralized in any way now? Because as you mentioned, HN's gone now.
Right.
And that was after the El Paso shootings, right? That was when it sort of became untenable, and then it sort of dissolved and went away. And now, what is it now? Where is this conversation happening? Because the truth is, I think for me, it's like the conversation's obviously bad, but the argument is tricky for me, because I don't know which one I think. Is it do I want to get rid of it, or do I want to know exactly where it is so we can know exactly what these people are thinking and talking about? You know what I mean? Like, is it better to have it them be underground in communication with themselves, out of the view of anyone? Or is it better to have them centralized at a place like HN where we can fucking see it, you know?
Right.
I'm torn. Yeah. I don't know what to think, you know?
Right. I do imagine that the police and the other services like that were monitoring these sites. And I think it was good that HN was shut down, that what it was doing, like the copycat shooter in Poway, California, who shot up the Tree of Life Synagogue.
Right.
He was like 22, and in his manifesto, he was discussing how he hadn't been there long.
Right.
But it was just obvious, or it seemed from what we knew, that he was brainwashed. It's a naive little like kid that for some reason became this horrible, unhinged, murdering terrorist. But it seemed clear that HN had a lot to do with it.
Right.
That's because he said that explicitly in his manifesto. So to me, it was good that for bringing new young people into the movement, it was doing that. So it was. I'm glad that it's gone.
Right. Right.
And it was too licentious. It really was. Lawless, that they really were letting anything go there. HN is 4chan is a little more moderated. It still exists, so they could still go there. My discussion talking with people who were part of it in 2016 who identified as fascists, weirdly enough, this might just be the ones that I've talked to, that they've a little like mellowed out a little, like they haven't not become fascist, but they're not like on 4chan all the time. They're just sort of like, they're not hardcore dyed in the wool Trumpers. They're just still angry, and they're still racist and fascist, but they haven't really found, they're not like fired up over a new candidate or anything. But they still exist. A lot of them, I've spoken to ones that have grown out of it. So a lot of them kind of think, oh, it's a phase. I was there for a little while. I got caught up in it. I was kind of a sad young man of 28 or whatever, mm-hmm. or 22.
Right.
And now I grew out of it. So it did feel like sort of this phase, a cultural moment in a sense. But to me, I suspect that since the underlying factors are still there, that these young men are still in more or less the same position, that it'll coalesce somewhere else. Probably not 4chan anymore. I thought the story of 4chan was over after Anonymous. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, okay, right. Nothing else. That was it. That was the story of 4chan. And then this other crazy thing happened out of nowhere. So it might be that something new and weird comes out of it in the next few years.
You mentioned some of the people that have left. You've seen so many phases of this and so many types of people coming in and out. I guess the way to think of it is similar to like an ideology of a cult or like a drug, this idea of, you know, you get sucked in and then this becomes your mindset and then there's no way out. But I don't know how helpful that is ultimately to really think of it that way. Like what, You describe some of these guys as saying it was a phase and they grew out of it, but obviously that's just not true for some of them.
Right.
What is like the likelihood of someone actually growing out of it without sort of a change in fortune? Because as you mentioned, there's the socioeconomic situations of these people. Those aren't changing. Trump, no Trump. It's still they're perceiving themselves and maybe in reality at the bottom of some kind of hierarchy that makes them angry, you know?
Right.
So what I'm assuming if they're not going to leave that station and if they might not ever come out of that. So like, what is this prognosis here? Not that you know, but like, what are we looking at here, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't have a lot of data to work with. Just the people I spoke to, I don't know how much that skews one way or the other. Right. To me, it feels like not so much, though I think to some people it really was this brainwashing, this cult feeling that they were in. That's a typical description. But a lot of times I hear, which I think is true of everyone who spent some years in the Chans, was that it was just a shitty period in their life. They're just like, this was a bad time in my life.
Right.
And I think for some people it was that as well, that they were going through this dark period and they ended up doing this or sort of getting obsessed over this or spending a lot of time in 4chan convinced of these ideas. And so maybe I'm an optimist, but to me, a lot of them were young or naive or mutable and just in their position too. They were like constantly in this identity crisis. They're like, I need to get my life together.
Yeah.
Which meant that, they were changing their minds all the time. So one of the weird things that happens is that the Chans, like during this period when all of the ones that they started, all these terrorist acts started occurring that were Chan influenced. Uh-huh. The Chans also became the pole and the fascist section of the Chans became enamored of Andrew Yang, and a lot of these young men there was a big split. And it's still there that a lot of them do now support Andrew Yang, who is a socialist, you might argue, for universal basic income. So huge, wild swing. But to, I think, a lot of these young men, they were like, oh, well, this solves my problem.
Right.
A lot of them, some of them were like, oh, I'm still a nihilist. I'm going to take there's the red pill, which is the fascist pill. And then there's the black pill, which is the nihilist pill. And they said, I'm going to just use it to take the black pill. I'm just going to drop out, spend my $1,000 a month on playing video games and being dropped out. But I think other people were like, no, this is better than what Trump offered. So that to me is the underlying argument that I think actually, if the left could offer them a way in, and sort of offer real, the left has much better solutions for them.
Right.
And since they're young and able to be influenced, that would be the best way to break apart the movement.
There's this interesting thing about the right now. I mean, just me growing up in my whole life, really, I thought of this sort of punk mentality as being sort of almost inherently, naturally, never not going to rise from the left.
Right.
But as, you know, Trumpism became a thing, punk now is in our culture, it's really aligned with the right, you know, and it's this weird, I think, allure for these angry young men who actually don't have an ideology. They just want to be punks. There's like a direct, line from being punk to being a troll almost, you know. There's a very deeply similar thing, although I much prefer punks, but it's similar, you know. It's this idea of like that it's not about what Trump is offering them so much as it is about his way, the way he is, the fact that he's a troll and he's just a big middle finger candidate that in itself is the appeal. And I think they're sliding all over ideology where, you know, at first, you know, it gave rise to Anonymous and then became, which was a far left thing and then became a far right thing. And now it's like some are being peeled off by someone like Andrew Yang is actually offering progressive ideas and is on the left. It just speaks to the fact that it really at its heart it's kind of just about, at the end of it all, it's just about the middle finger, you know? And if you give them a reason to put it down, like $1,000 a month, maybe they actually will. But until then, they're just fucking angry and they're going to align with the anger candidate, you know?
Right. Yeah. I've definitely seen like kids wear MAGA hats with these like big grins on their faces, knowing that they're probably just offending everyone by wearing the hats.
It's so weird. Yeah. It's so true. I saw this video recently and it was this guy, he was sitting in the front row of a plane and he was like, he had a MAGA hat on and he's like giggling like he's just about to fucking own everybody on the plane. And then all he does is he turns his hat around. So Make America Great Again is facing the rest of the plane, and he acts like he fucking just owned them. And oh, it's this weird thing where it's like the guy is the fucking president. How punk can you be by having support for the person who was elected president? That's like it seems to run counter to everything there could ever be that's punk.
Yet it's
still true, you know? And I almost wish the left could find that punkness again. So it has it on offer to say, well, actually, it's way more punk to be this way than it is to just wear the fucking hat that is representative of the guy who's actually president. It just it doesn't make sense on a lot of levels, but it I think underneath it all, it's this desire to just be a punk, you know?
Right. Yeah, I try and address that a little in the book with this idea that around 2012 or 2013, the left on the internet as well through Tumblr, now more or less defunct social media site, took this turn towards hyper politeness, where the last of that countercultural 60s, which was very male themed about sort of I'm a man, I'm going to do what I want, and sort of like I'm trying to find my libertarian style freedom.
Right.
Which was part of the counterculture movement of the 60s and the punk movement of the 70s. By 2012, 2013, this Tumblr culture of being hyper-accommodating and polite to the extent that you ask people their pronouns and their and they have a certain vision of themselves, and you want to make sure that you understand that vision and express it to them the way they want. And it's very courtly almost. That broke the last of 4chan. That was exactly when Anonymous was disintegrating and this new group of incels and self-proclaimed beta males on 4chan was growing, and they hated Tumblr. It pushed them really far away from that left because they were so angry. They wanted to spit in someone's face.
Right.
They wanted, something that was rebellious and that was, not polite at all. So it's curious. Yeah. I mean, the other problem is co-optation that corporations and so forth have eaten up all of these social movements. So sometimes you get all of these leftist slogans then become mixed up with the establishment.
Yeah.
And then you're kind of then the problem is created then, right? Then it's
totally,
you feel like, oh, you're just actually helping the establishment. You're not breaking it down.
Yeah. You mentioned in the book, the resentment sort of the alliance of that, of minorities, or diversity in general, really. Corporations and sort of naturally the coastal elite. And that is interesting because that it's almost like it's this weird fallout effect of the status quo seeming like it's aligned with the left. And if that's the case, then I have to be punk and on the right, you know. It's this weird thing of like through their eyes, they're seeing that alliance of globalism, diversity, and corporate culture as a sign that they're the status quo and they're what sort of they can't be, really.
Right. Yeah. And certainly that's part of the right ideology that, yeah, they see that coziness. And it's something the left notices when there's a gay pride parade and it's Facebook and like big banks coming out and you see those institutions, the most prominent people marching the parade. And the left is like, oh no.
Right.
Like what?
Right.
Who have we gotten in bed with, so to speak, right? Like, so it's a danger. In the book, I call it a dangerous alignment that to be very careful about making sure that the change that the left is looking for is radical change, that it really is not aligning itself with corporate interests or not asking some corporation, sort of beseeching them to make some sort of minor tweak to their products or telling us that, you know, giving us some minor accommodation, but really challenging the status quo in a rebellious, fragmenting way. That's something that seems dangerous to them, right? If they like the message the left is giving out, that probably means that the left is not giving out the right message.
Right. I mean, what I look at and I see that sort of a lot of, I think, that alliance is born out of corporations just being like, oh, that's a thing now. I'm going to co-opt that because we'll make more money. You know, it's like, oh, now we can sell things to gay people. Yeah, obviously we're going to do that. We don't give a fuck what they believe. We just want to make money, you know? And it's right. This weird fucked up thing that I think some people actually on the left are blind to. It's like you want these corporations obviously to appeal to everybody, but they're also they are actually being exploitative and it's not really noticed very often, but it is sort of biting us, if I can say us, on the left in the ass, because it's turning a large swath of people who actually don't have an ideology and they're running into this other ideology almost as a knee-jerk reaction. But really all it is a corporation saying, we want to make more money. And that's it.
Right.
That's all it is. You know, it's not some political, social, cultural stance. All they want to do is have a new demographic that they can openly sell to.
Right. Yeah. Their motives are very nihilistic in a sense.
Right. Yeah.
It's like wherever the profit margin is. Yeah. That's exactly what they will.
Yeah.
That's exactly what they will do. Yeah. But then, there are unintended consequences.
Yeah. And it's just depressing to think of it that way, because it's again, corporations are well, to the short version is corporations are just fucking it all up again in just a different and new and modern way, you know, just driving people away from us, co-opting the shit that actually is meaningful, making it meaningless, and then sort of ruining other things in the process.
Right. Well, that's the fundamental problem of capitalism and co-optation, right?
Yes. Right. Which you trace in general. I mean, the counterculture of the 70s, that was co-opted. And then through the 90s, that was co-opted. And then, you know, the picture you paint, which I think is an accurate one, is that by the early 2000s into 2010, there was no place to go that wasn't possible to be co-opted. Everything had been co-opted, and you could actually look back and see evidence of that co-optation. And then it's like, well, we're going to actually be nothing, so you can't co-op nothing. You can't sell nothing, you know? And so that's just another fucking unpleasant place co-optation brings us. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And you can, it's still the prevailing, even though I call it like 90s nihilism, which is, I guess, when it first started, like youth culture today, it's still the prevailing idea that they're sort of like frazzled because there's just so much junk and information coming at them. And so, I don't know. I feel like it's still a prevailing attitude where young people are just like, it doesn't matter. I don't even know.
Yeah. I mean, when I was reading your book, I was struck with this realization that if I was young now, like a teenager now, I am pretty sure I'd be a complete nihilist. I would, if I'm right in being able to access sort of my the way that my brain worked back then, I wouldn't have enough perspective to think, well, this is just another moment in time. The moment in time when you're that age, that's all of time, because it's all you really know. And to look out at the world now, it just seems so topsy-turvy. There's information coming in all the time. None of it goes with the other information that's right behind it. And you're just like, well, what the fuck, like what is any what is any of this? What am I doing? What does anything mean? And it's it seems, again, you talk about the self-perpetuating thing, it almost seems like it's creating the situation for its own metastasization, because you're just like, well, yeah, now nihilism becomes a lot easier to adhere to in the face of not only all this nihilism but all this confusing shit that doesn't make sense. You're just going to naturally lean that way, or at least be more likely to, you know?
Right.
And so I think being a young person now is, I don't know. It's fucking sounds terrifying.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could see why that it's deeply polarized and deeply radical, where either there's not a lot of young centrists, right?
Right, yeah.
It's so true, the people who are like, we need to wipe it all away and start a system that's more fair and just, and that like addresses climate change, that the world's going to end, right? Like these sort of things, or they become fascists, that they're still all that for that same reason, because they're in that exact same position of this unhappy nihilism. They say, oh, well, modern society was a mistake. We need to wipe it away and create authoritarian traditionalism or whatever.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I think people, myself included, on the left think of, well, young people seem to have it together. When, you know, you see Greta and it's like they know what's up. They have like a mission and they're on the left. It's like it's obviously preferable than the opposite, than the inverse of that. But is that even true? Is what someone like I am seeing, is that an actual reflection of young people, or is it sort of more evenly distributed, where it's yes, they're likely more likely to be extreme about their ideology, but they could be on the left or right? Is there like any sort of?
I think that, well, to your point there, I think that's a fair point. You're like, well, how much do they have their shit together? How much do they understand? I do think that I was going to say the other thing that I think. If I were young today, I would be even more caught up in the elaborate labyrinths and mazes and attention mazes that corporations have built for me and for young people more than I am now.
Yeah.
As right. Like that more than ever, young people are born into this maze of addictive technology that totally outclasses them. And in that is the messaging and the marketing, which was also outclassing us and me when I was a younger person, but it's just grown even further. So there are more confusing labyrinths, more confusing dead ends that they're probably, you know, the compared to like what, to me, like what TV, how TV was addicting in the 90s or whatever, like how apps are designed, like these sharpened knives to just suck away your attention, whether it's like TikTok or Twitter or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, and then all of the political sentiments and all of these things get echoed into those places.
Yeah.
Where they're kind of lost just in the echo chamber. So to me there, it's great to see. I think what you're saying is true, that there's actually both. That there's a sort of this intense clarity where young people are like, the world is going to end.
Yeah.
Right, that we're going to have this international world dominating crisis.
Yeah,
if we don't rebuild, we don't do something very soon. Sort of very clear that something very different needs to happen. And on the left, you're like, you just look at the person in power. Like, how did someone who is the most immature and incompetent and incapable? How is our system functioning if that's the person who is at the top leading? Right, like it's just very clear.
Yeah,
in so many ways. But the other. But part of that clarity and dysfunction of the dysfunction comes from this hyper complexity, like rhizomic, I guess is the philosophical term for all of this, right? That that is trying to constantly entrap people and sort of confuse them in this weird hall of mirrors and attention. And so, yeah, I think young people are struggling for that with that as well. They're doing both at the same time. Maybe all of us are.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I shudder at the thought of being a young person now. It just seems like not a good time to be like 14, you know, that would just be fucking, that's too much to even think about.
Maybe we've got it entirely wrong and they're just like, just totally on.
I'm
on point. I
so don't know that I'm just as likely to believe that than I am my natural inclination, because it's hard to think about. I mean, I was what, like the internet was really dial up, like it was becoming a thing at all when I was like 12. And so my mind, like I have no frame of reference really at all of what it would be like to not only have what exists now at your fingertips, but also to have grown up from 1 year old or up to 14 with that technology in some form or another as well. Like I have no idea what that is even like. And so I feel like I could believe anything, because I'm so like, I don't fucking know. Jeez, how the hell can I know? It's so impossible to access, you know?
Yeah.
I feel the same way. I mean, I wrote in the book that I felt like that labyrinth that you're describing, I watched it grow up around me.
Yeah, yeah.
Where the internet was not sharpened into this place that grabs your attention and competes for calibrating your value system every moment and convinces you to do these things, because if you do them, then some large company or software engineer is going to get a fraction of a penny the longer you spend on Snapchat or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. Like, totally. Like, that's not what it was.
Yep.
But the people most susceptible to that are young people.
Yeah.
And a lot of the sort of inventions of the like roly poly freewheeling internet, which 4chan invented, like memes and things like that. And they got wrapped up in all those attention sucking apps that target young people. So it's a frightening online landscape, at least. Young people are navigating it better than I would expect.
Yeah. The only thing to hope, I think, is just don't fall too far down any one rabbit hole. I think the one good thing the good thing the internet does is that you actually can look up or read about anything. So at least there's ways out of whatever rabbit hole you're down. So maybe consider like other rabbit holes if you're in one. Yeah.
That's right. That's like the flip side of the ennui and the like information overload is that you can actually just go shallowly down each rabbit hole.
Yeah, exactly.
And not tumble down one. I like that.
And maybe recognize the absurdity of them all, or the similarity really ultimately of them all. Rabbit holes are
right.
You know? All right, cool. Well, I've had you for over the amount of time I said I would. I appreciate your time. Is there anything else you want to mention or talk about? I mean, I know you have your book that we mentioned, but you can plug it now.
You guys, buy my book. It Came From Something Awful: How a Toxic Troll Army Accidentally Memed Donald Trump into Office. It's the worst of the internet. Collect it in book form. This is great. Great questions. I really enjoyed the conversation. Appreciate you having me.
So did I. And the book, for everyone who's listening, is genuinely, genuinely great. And thank you, Dale, for being a guest on the show. Thank you for writing it. And thanks for your time.
Yeah, thanks so much.